My guest is Tom McTague. Tom McTague is the editor of the weekly magazine, The New Statesman, and the author of a new book called Between the Waves: The Hidden History of a Very British Revolution, 1945 to 2016. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Right. So, first things first, why write this book on this topic and at this time?
The first thing I have to say, I guess, is that I started it quite a few years ago, about 4 years ago now, a time when, Brexit was still very much in the news. Britain had only left the EU a few months before, I think, when I actually began putting pen to paper on this subject. So it was still very fresh in my mind. But the real reason was actually a number of books that I'd read at that period, which kind of came together to influence my thinking. There were some books in the States about the conservative revolution there that were really influential on me. There was one called Before the Storm, and it charted the decision of the Republican Party to nominate Barry Goldwater in 1964. And this is the beginning, the opening of the story. And it says, the Republican Party has done what no party in America thought was ever possible. It's nominated an ideological conservative. And then it charts how they'd got he'd gone on to lose this crushing landslide defeat to Lyndon Johnson. And everybody in the United States said, well, if this only proves that if you become a conservative party, the Republican Party is doomed to defeat permanently in American politics. And of course, that didn't happen. And the arc of the story is one of this rising tide of conservative ideology in the States, culminating in the victory of Ronald Reagan. So I suddenly thought, God, that is very similar to the Eurosceptic story in Britain. This one of defeat after defeat after defeat. Starting with the entry in 73, the vote to go in first in 71, the referendum defeat for the Eurosceptics in 1975. You could take that story, the loss of Margaret Thatcher, their great heroine, all the way through to Tony Blair in 1997, where the idea that Britain would leave the European Union at that point would have been seen as completely ludicrous, unthinkable, really. And then that was the time that a second book came out by Hugo Young called This Blessed Plot, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. And the thesis of Hugo's book, which is a history like mine of Britain's relationship with Europe from 1945 all the way through, was essentially that Britain had fought against a future that it couldn't avoid. And that destiny, that future, was to membership of the European Union. And he has a line in his introduction where he says, that destiny is proved by the outcome, Britain's membership. So the very fact that we were in made all of these struggles in the past a kind of absurd spectacle, because they were always struggling against the inevitable, which was membership. And of course, thinking about that story in 2020, once Britain had left, made you think completely differently about the history. Things weren't inevitable. Their, electoral defeats weren't the end of a story. Sometimes tides kept rising, like they did in the United States, and like eventually they did in the UK.
Right. Well, as you said just now, a lot of the book is about, in effect, the tenacity of the whatever you want to call them, Eurosceptics, anti-Europeans, or whatever. They have different names, different labels. But before we get to that, is the history, which is now documented, as you say, in Hugo Young's book, but now in your book, about the skepticism, if you like, in a very pure sense, of the British establishment about the whole European project.
Yes, yes,
Before there
yes.
were kind of campaign groups lobbying to actually leave something which didn't even exist yet. We had the establishment and also the diplomats and the civil servants. They were very much in the forefront, it seems to me, of trying to shape the UK foreign policy after the Second World War. What's your take on how influential these relatively unknown but quite senior civil servants were in the immediate sort of post-war period?
They were very influential. I mean, I think obviously, to begin with, in that immediate post-war period, they were more influential on the continent in terms of setting up the European foundations that have built into what exists today. Obviously, the lead figure there is Jean Monnet. In many senses, the kind of archetypal bureaucratic power. He was a remarkable man in so many ways. and I think a nobleman, and that he had there was a nobility at the heart of his ideas for bringing peace to the continent. But that wasn't the only mission that Jean Monnet had. It was a much grander vision, actually, that I've discovered researching this book. That he really was a Euro-Atlanticist. He believed he was an Anglophile. He believed in a union of the free world, and he saw that initially as three component parts: Europe, by which he meant the continent of Europe, and at that time, of course, the Western part of the continent, the United States and North America. And the third component part, which wasn't controversial to him at the time, was the British Empire, which was just about still in existence at the beginning. Now, he saw it as these three component parts, and he has these moments of clarity where he says, France, Germany, much of the continent is lying in ruins. And he says, Britain and America have their own worlds to fall back on. Europe doesn't. Europe needs to create. To sort of drag itself up, and it needs to create its own world. And he wanted some kind of association with Britain. And of course, Britain at the time, under Churchill and others, wanted an association of sorts with Europe. Now, I think what happens is that you have a much more radical change after 1945, in which British power relatively starts to ebb quite quickly. European power starts to grow, in part thanks to Monet's vision, and American power comes to utterly dominate. And this combination starts to play into the psyche of the British civil servants and others that you mentioned, where they start to panic about the loss of British influence. And fundamentally, it's Britain's inability to stop this European project from coming to pass. Everyone assumed that Britain had some kind of veto over European unity, because Britain had a veto on this until that point. Britain had always been able to rely on a partnership and alliance with France, where France would not break the alliance to go into something else, because their security depended on the security relationship with Britain. Now, the great change is the impact of American power. And America saying to encouraging France to take the leap into this European coal and steel community, because ultimately they had replaced Britain as the guarantor of French security. And that meant that the alliance could France could change its grand strategic bargain. And over time, you then had these figures. There was one called Bretherton. There are others who start to say to advise the British government, this thing has formed and it's real on our doorstep. And we have only one choice, which is to effectively, we need to get in there and start to influence it and start to make it a bit more British. And I think this gets to the heart of Britain's relationship and why it's always been quite tricky compared to, the French feelings about Europe or Germany's or the Netherlands or Belgium or any other country. That obviously Britain did not feel was not defeated in the Second World War. And it's always sought to use Europe to project British power. It is sought to maintain influence. It doesn't really, it's I don't think it's ever fundamentally believed in the project that Monet had set up. Monet had an idea at its core, which was federalism. Britain never believed in it, and it tried to join, and it did eventually join for, I think, slightly different reasons. And that tension has always been there.
And I came across a quote of Jean Monnet. He was asked, apparently, why did British politicians decide not to join the European project, basically, as it was so much in their own interest. And he replies, "I came to the conclusion that it must have been because it was the price of victory, the illusion that you could maintain what you had without change." That's more or less what you're saying, right? We had these delusions that we could actually either block or dilute or delay the European project, or at least once in the inside, just shape it to our own taste.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think Monet has been, in some senses, a bit harsh there, in that I think if you read his early letters, he was full of the same delusion. He didn't think Britain was going to be a same kind of face the same dilemmas as France and Germany. He thought that it would survive in its own way. I think he still arrives at a truth, a profound truth that is not really possible to get past. You know, it's part of our history. The fact that Britain did not lose, was not conquered, was not destroyed in the same way is fundamentally important. If you go and read those debates in the 1950s about British entry into the coal and steel community, they're painfully, searingly honest about the dilemma. And, you know, between Anthony Eden on one side and Clement Attlee on the other. And you have to remember that at that time, when Britain was being asked to put coal and steel into a sort of federal authority controlled in Brussels or in Luxembourg, that was a remarkably difficult thing for a British government to do. At the time, you had a democratic socialist government, a Labour government with a parliamentary majority that has nationalised coal, and that has been an absolutely core part of its agenda. And it's managed to do that because it has control of parliament. And what's more, Britain is wealthier than the continent at this time. So those coal miners who are Labour supporters that are working for a nationalised industry are paid more than they are on the continent. It is almost impossible, I think, for any government to have taken Britain in the 1950s. The alignment was just not possible. So I think when we project back from today and we think, you know, these sort of, as some people would put it, these kind of idiotic people who were too blinded by victory or notions of grandeur, there's also just kind of practical reality about what is possible.
Well, let's move it forward a bit then. So the UK finally joins the EEC, and okay, there's a couple of ups and downs, like the 1975 referendum, which reconfirms quite dramatically our commitment finally to being part of the EEC, as it was called in those days. But I think the core of your book, and I was quite taken aback, I thought you talk about things that maybe the readers might think, oh, I knew all that, but you bring it all together. I'm talking about, in effect, how you said earlier, the tenacity and never giving up of the Eurosceptics, who come from different walks of life, professional backgrounds, not just politicians, the media, obviously, business people who are funding some of this stuff, advisors, people behind the scenes, and how they start, some of them started quite young, but they persisted, even though it was many times in the political agenda, not a popular thing to support.
Yes, and I think this is an interesting lesson for me, at least in history. I think I spent a long time, you know, of my earlier life thinking, just assuming naturally that elections were the, in a sense, the only thing that mattered. The politics was about winning or losing elections. And the winners of elections shaped history. They got power. And therefore they sort of dragged country one way or the other. And that was in essence the story of history, or post-war history, democratic history, European, British, American, you know, history. Now, that I think is a naive view on my part. And looking at this story, you can see the importance of currents that are pulling at a country under the surface in different ways than it first appears. You know, when you're looking from above. And that is a sort of a big part of my book, is to try and think about that. And you can have multiple examples. The example you've just given of, you know, 1975, where almost everyone was writing that this question is over. Now, you think about this question of British membership of Europe. You know, you think about people like Neil Kinnock, who, you know, a future sort of great pro-European, who is at the time a fierce Eurosceptic, because of course the left of the Labour Party was Eurosceptic. That back then, broadly speaking, it was the left that was Eurosceptic and the right which was pro-European. And the democratic socialists of Kinnock and Benn, Foote and others were skeptics. And Kinnock says, you know, hands up, you know, we've lost, and the question is settled forever when we're ever going back out. And for most of the rest of Kinnock's life, he was right, of course. But this idea of inevitability is, I think, something that we should challenge, this idea that things are settled permanently. But you also had people who were saying, if the result had gone the other way, you would have had these terrible situations where the left of the party would have taken control of Labour, the Eurosceptic right would have emerged more triumphant. Now, all of these things came to pass, regardless of the result of the 1975 election. So, within 4 years, you have Margaret Thatcher's victory in 79. You have a few years after that, you have the split of the Labour Party, the emergence of the Social Democratic Party, pro-European party, which pretty much guarantees Thatcher's triumph throughout the 80s. And you have the emergence of, once again, a much more vocally Eurosceptic Labour Party. And so what you have is a kind of a constant battle for the kind of zeitgeist. And you have new challenges that emerge, which create new reactions in Europe. And so I think when you're trying to measure this history, you have to think about both what is going on in Britain, but also the fact that Europe is not a singular static block. From its very beginning, it has at its core, this idea of ever closer union, which is part of the genius of Monet's creation. And the very fact that it does move closer together gradually and new projects are born necessarily means that there is going to be reactions from particularly places that are more instinctively Eurosceptic, like Britain. And of course, the great story here is the move towards a single currency. And that really is the first chink in what had been a kind of consensus position from 1973 up until the late 1990s.
Could you have imagined writing a book or devoting some of your new book to the kind of the mirror image there? In other words, the pro-European, because obviously a big focus of your book is how the Eurosceptics never give up. They caucus, they organize, sometimes with great setbacks. They always seem to bounce back. Is there an equivalent story to be written about the pro-Europeans, or were they maybe guilty of a certain complacency? You said earlier that the question, quote unquote, was settled, and therefore there's no need to be quite as organized as the Eurosceptics.
Yeah, I mean, I think though, if you were good to tell a kind of dramatic story of, Europe pro-European victory, you'd probably start it, in the turn of the century, 1900s, the emergence of these ideas of a federal Europe or of a United States of Europe, a reaction obviously to the success and the growing power of the United States in America. And you'd have the you'd have these ideas forming that of course then influence Jean Monnet as he's coming to prominence in the well, he comes to prominence in the First World War, but then in the second, so you would tell a story and it would have a different timeline, and it would end with the creation in the Treaty of Rome in 58 and these things, and then probably British entry in 73, and you have this you have this dramatic scene of Harold Macmillan on the White Cliffs of Dover lighting a lantern that is then responded to in France by Jean Monnet. You have these very evocative moments where these people who had pursued their goal doggedly had triumphed. As you say, I think it changes once you become the establishment, in a sense. Once you become the ones that have achieved your goal, you're not the resistance anymore. And the resistance gets a certain momentum or power, or they have something to resist against. You could tell a story about a pro-European success in Britain, but I think it's the one, in a sense, that Hugo Young tells, and it's not as noble or romantic because it always involves necessarily a degree of kind of politicking. It's a degree of kind of obfuscation, in a sense. It's a degree of deception, and obviously he, this blessed plot, the meaning of that title from Hugo Young, who is an avowed, pro-European, is that his frustration with pro-European British politicians, that they weren't able to be honest about the nature of the European Union or the EC, the nature of Monet's dream, in which things come together and you give up bits of national sovereignty and you share sovereignty, you pool it into this new body that has its own sovereignty. And through that body, you get all of these benefits. And you have to speak in those terms. And the only politician, the only prime minister in Britain who's ever done that is Edward Heath.
Right.
And that is, Tony Blair came close at times, but if you read his speeches, they're not, they really, again, they don't speak in that language. They don't speak as a federal, as a federalist. Edward Heath was a convinced European in that he believed in a European identity, in a European civilization, in a European project. He believed in a smaller Europe. He opposed European expansion into the East because he thought it would undermine it from within. This was, and I think what is interesting if you think about British history is that the very fact that he was the only Prime Minister we've had who could speak in that way is also revealing in itself.
Right. And as you say in the book, I'm quoting your words back at you, the European project never had been and never would be dependent on British approval. From the moment of Robert Schuman's declaration in 1950, this has been the lesson that Britain has seemed incapable of learning. And do you have the impression even now, I mean, we've obviously left the European Union, but we on from the outside, we don't seem to still don't get what the EU is all about.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case. And you can see that in the, Maastricht, when the same old story presents itself. It's one of further integration at a cost of a loss of sovereignty. Losing your national currency, this is not something that pro-Europeans should be squeamish about, is a loss of sovereignty. Of
Yeah.
course it is. But it comes with, the idea is, it comes with benefits. And I think that trade-off has never been something that the pro-Europeans have been very good at explaining. But you start to see that difference, that chink then. You start to see Britain pull away, having a sort of special place within Europe where we were inside the single market but outside the single currency. And I think not really being able to find a place in which Britain felt comfortable. And trying to, if you read those speeches, Margaret Thatcher in Bruges 1988, John Major throughout the 90s, Tony Blair even thereafter, they will make arguments about what Europe should be. And they are arguments about something that doesn't exist. So they will say Europe should be this. It should be a free trading bloc that shouldn't concern itself with these theocratic notions or theistic notions about sort of ever closer union and federal. But that is entirely to miss the point. Even Blair would be guilty of this. And what they do is they set up an idea, which is actually a British idea of what they want Europe to be, that Britain would be comfortable. And the reality is something very different, which keeps showing itself in. Now, I think there is something different happening now.
Let's interrupt. I'm asking the question also because although your book finishes in 2016, I just wonder whether there are lessons to be learned in the current situation because we're now, the UK and EU are engaged in quite intense negotiations on a variety of fronts, the famous reset or the strategic partnership. That the UK in particular is keen to establish. I just wonder whether we are doomed to, again, through a lack of appreciation, make similar mistakes we've been making for the past decades.
Yes, I think that's possible, but I think it's also nothing is inevitable. I hope that's one lesson of the book. We can't map out the future. We can't know what's going to happen. There is a way in which a more mature relationship emerges. One perhaps even of the sort that Monet envisaged at the beginning, where you have a kind of special relationship between a European bloc and its closest and sort of most powerful neighbor. Or one of its most powerful neighbors is, a neighbor of which is an ally rather than a neighbor which is a sort of an enemy in terms of Russia. And I think that is, it's not possible to say whether that's going to happen. But I think what you're seeing also a Europe that's changing. And I think this is really, really important. And another part of the story, it's part of the story that I've told out throughout the book and throughout this podcast, which is that we have to, in Britain, think or accept that Europe is not this static block, that Europe is changing itself, responding to events. And that is necessarily going to change how Britain interacts with it. There are some interesting theories on this side of the channel that as Europe moves rightwards and becomes more nationalistic and more civilizational, actually, and sort of fortress Europe, that the case for rejoining Europe will start to be made by the right in Britain, who support Meloni, and they look to the German examples of how you deal with refugees, or Le Pen, or any of these figures, and they think, Well, actually, we feel more similar to that than to what's going on in the United States. That I'm not saying that that's at all likely. I just think it's interesting that that is starting to bubble up as a as an argument here. But the truth is, what is going to happen in the European Union? How is it going to change? It's already changed since Britain left, but it's not changed. And this is an interesting one. It's not changing as Monnet and Delors and others would like. It doesn't seem to be coming together, or certainly not very quickly, towards a kind of ever closer union. From the outside, it appears quite messy and contested and difficult. And so it's not clear what kind of Europe is going to emerge. And therefore, it's not clear what kind of Europe Britain is going to be engaging with. Of course, over here, we don't know what kind of Britain we're going to have in 5 years' time. Are we going to have a Britain run by Nigel Farage, or one run by Keir Starmer or Andy Burnham or Jeremy Corbyn or whoever? And so I would say that the future isn't set, but the dilemmas are always the same.
Well, let's keep all those thoughts for our future podcast, Tom. In the meantime, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.